Preston and Steve Fun Size.
So next guest is in town for screenings of his new film, Jay and Silent Bob. It's the reboot, and it will be in theaters on November 29th. Ladies and gentlemen, Kevin Smith is right here.
Kids.
In our studio.
How are you?
Wonderful. How are you?
I'm not prepared for the East Coast at all. After the heart attack, I went vegan and lost weight, and now everything is cold. Like, I have no insulation whatsoever.
You're now basically an Olympian.
But I am down to my high school weight. But I don't remember this being this cold in high school all the time.
When you lose the insulation,
I feel like a little old man. Like, right down to my bones, I'm like, oh, the chill.
What'd you do with all your jerseys? There's no way they fit anymore.
They didn't. I eventually boxed them all up, signed every one of them, and then on the second part of the tour, we give that out to, like, VIPs.
Wow. Yeah,
what we call game-worn jerseys. But I stopped wearing them. So weird. Like, after I dropped some weight, I shrank the jerseys. I was like, all right, I'll go to a smaller jersey. And I felt like, oh, my God, I look stupid. And my wife was like, you always look stupid. And I was like, really? And she's like, yeah. She's going, you know, the suit jacket suits you and stuff.
And actually, this is the new Kevin Smith.
I defaulted to, like, my 1997 look. This is what I was wearing before, like, I put on weight and said, oh, the hockey jersey is a fat guy's moo-moo.
Well, you look great.
It is.
Thank you. Oh, my God, you're so sweet. I was sitting here listening to your traffic report, and I was just like, what a skill. Like, it is. It's a very specialized skill. That's why there's always somebody doing it very specifically.
We had the cast of Downton Abbey sitting here. We had all the other and people come in. I think Jane Goodall was here, and they all marvel at this. I'm like, well, then Kevin, Traffic, the movie.
It's clearly a movie.
I remember when I was a kid, like morning radio would do Traffic, and somebody was in a helicopter at all times, and I was thinking, you got it easy, man. Like,
yeah,
somebody feeds you a few lines, and you're like, yes, this is what's happening.
We sent her up one time, and she had no idea where she was.
She could not identify main thoroughfares.
There's traffic below me. I just don't know where it is.
Well, here's the thing you have to know about me is I'm scared of everything. Right. Yeah. So going up in a helicopter was like a fear that I had to face.
Yeah,
so
I'm
the roads below me, I didn't care, even though that was part of what they wanted me to do. And I was like, I don't know where we are. I don't want to look down. And then the pilot goes, do you want me to show you how, like, if the helicopter stalls, how we get down? And I was like, if you do that, like, I'm going to die right now. No, absolutely not.
Let me show you what it's like if we're going to go down.
No, I don't want that.
It's not without precedent, too, because traffic helicopters have crashed on
air. No doubt.
So you're wise. Just do it through the computer.
I remember I got my wife, like, a gift. She wanted to go to San Simeon is where the Hearst Castle is.
It's amazing, yeah.
So we live in, like, Los Angeles. And so, you know, she's always talking about helicopters. And I found a helicopter ride to him. It was me and my wife and her parents and my kid. So in my mind, it's like the helicopter from, like, Meet Joe Black, the one that Anthony Hopkins
yes,
is in.
That's going to be.
Oh, my God. It's plush.
Right.
It looks like the inside of a plane or something.
Yeah.
And it was one of them traffic helicopters where you could see out from under you, underneath the whole flight. And I panicked. I was like, I'm not going. Wow. My wife's like, what do you mean? I was like, I can't look at that. That looks unsafe. She's like, we're all going. I was like, well, then you're all stupid. I'm going to drive. And she was like, she asked the guy, she was like, if he drives, how long is it? The guy was like, it's going to take him 4 hours. We're going to be there in like 35 minutes. And she was like, you have to do this. It's for my birthday. And we got into a legit fight.
Wow.
On the runway while my kid was standing there watching, going, my parents are codependent. And I was going, like, if I die in this helicopter, I'm going to be so mad at you. Like, I have it over you forever. She's like, just get in. It worked out. But it was terrifying.
Yeah.
And I didn't even have to report. I wasn't even like, the traffic is. I was just praying the whole time. I found the Lord again so quickly.
He's absolutely.
Yeah,
speaking
oh my God.
Of, you do get religion.
Yes. He didn't listen to me. He was like, you made dogma, so you could die.
Speaking of flying, you got to go to Boston after this.
Yeah.
And you've chosen to drive 7 hours instead of fly for 45 minutes.
You said seven when I asked you the other day. I was like, how long is it? You said seven in text. I was like, oh, my Lord. But then we all checked, and it's 4.5. So
no.
What route do you take? Because I want to avoid that. Like,
4.5 with the Boston. Plague. It took me 7 hours to drive back from Boston.
You hit traffic in Connecticut?
Maybe.
Always. That's the worst state ever.
Yeah.
That's the problem. You're probably not thinking about traffic.
It depends on what
you're
going. Oh,
no. You can't help but think about traffic. Like, especially if you want to do it. You just hit Waze, and Waze will tell you your future, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's a godsend.
It's a prognosticator. It's amazing. It's
the Nostradamus of traffic.
I'll do it right now.
It really is, man. But, do one from
I'm doing it from right here.
Do
but
it.
Why are you not flying?
We started, like, when we started the tour, it was in New Jersey, and then the next show was in Chicago, so we had to fly there. Once we got to Chicago, the next few shows were kind of Midwest bunched together, so we were like, well, let's drive it. And then being on the road felt good. Like, Jay was like, it's a road show. We should be on the road. He's like, I'll drive. And I was like, all right. So if we all split the driving, it would be great. But Jay is like a baby. The moment you turn the car on, he goes to sleep. So he has slept the whole ride. So sometimes I'm driving, and he's behind me, like, sleeping against the window. And then people drive past us, and they're like, holy crap. I would have assumed the other guy drove. Like,
right, right.
So he's been no help, but I've enjoyed kind of driving. It beats, like, dealing with the airport and crap like that. So just means sometimes you leave an extra hour earlier. Jay's a big Walmart shopper, so we stop at every Walmart we see.
I think the driving thing is cool. The touring thing is cool. And in a way, I was telling Preston, you know, this whole process of the Jay and Silent Bob reboot and this tour that you're doing kind of reminds you of the old days, like with William Castle going around and going.
We just don't have a Tingler, but right, I will touch you if you like.
Right.
And for extra money, for a VIP package, you will get tingled Kevin Smith.
But they go around to different towns and kind of whoop it up and sort of sell it that way.
It is. It's unbelievable for me. Like, number one, the tour is making crazy loot because we've been selling out everywhere. So that's first and foremost, it's a business and somebody
that's
else
awesome.
Is happy. But number
awesome.
Two, for me, it's like going to church every night where you're both the priest and Jesus. Like, everybody, you're celebrating the Mass, and everybody's celebrating you, man. It's like such a warm love fest. This, you're sitting down with every single person in the audience, gets every single joke, every Easter egg gets cracked open. Like, it's all for them. It's the movie's made for the world's biggest Kevin Smith fan, that's me. And then secondarily, the audience.
It's your crowd. Also, I think we talked about this last time. We just talked to you a couple of months ago, you know, on the phone and talking about it. There's multiple things in play here. There's that, you know, long-awaited, a revered franchise. And then also the you don't know what you got until it's gone thing of, you know, you're here. You survived a traumatic thing.
There is definitely that. The heart attack has really informed everything.
And then I think the fans are like, I'm going to go see his ass.
Yeah, in case he dies.
Yeah.
check him out. But last night we had two shows in Philly at the Prince Theater, which was absolutely beautiful. A total love fest. Like, anytime a character pops up that's been in one of the other movies, and there's lots of that throughout the movie, not just me and Jay, but, like, we got a sequel to Clerks, to Mallrats, to Chasing Amy, and Dogma, as well as Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back within the movie and stuff. So now that we're done, we move on to Boston. The movie opens here, was it Friday?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So it opens here in AMC Neshaminy 24.
Neshaminy.
Yeah. AMC Cherry Hill 24, that ain't here, but that's nearby here.
Yeah,
yeah, New Jersey.
And AMC Hamilton 24. So you can go see it there this week. We're not with the movie, but it rolls out behind us. So essentially our tour is like a very expensive promo for the movie coming to your area. Yeah, or a very cheap promo, depending on how you look at it.
It's funny because you think about, we've talked about this before with you, as you're a young filmmaker and you're sure in your mind, you know, I'm going to work my way up and get to these budgets and then and have this mechanism and studio and so on and so forth. And then you go and then you realize your pure joy lies with really the embryonic aspects of the film industry and the feet on the ground selling it.
It's the stuff I got to skip because, I got lucky somebody picked up Clerks. But this was the work that I was prepared for when we made Clerks. Like, oh, we're probably going to have to rent theaters and take it around because we don't have any help. But then all of a sudden, we had help. So now at this stage of my career, I found it more fun to go backwards and do the things I didn't do. Like, you know, I made Tusk and people were like, why? And I'm like, because I never made that in the beginning of my career. That's generally when people do things, the foolish things in the beginning of their career. But I skipped that step. So I'm like, I'm going to enjoy that step just late in the career. Same thing with the tour. It's like, a lot of people are like, hey, man, can't you just release it normally? And I'm like, yeah, give me $20 million, man, because that's what it costs to, quote unquote, normally release a movie. But doing it our way costs us very little to nothing. Like, I think we've spent about $100,000 for the entire tour so far. And then everything else is just kind of profit. You just have to be willing to go places.
Most filmmakers
aren't, right? They're like, I'll make the movie and it goes out in 2,000 theaters and that's it. But I'm happy to accompany it. We kind of specialize or eventize the idea of the screening. Like, I tell the cats every night, you know, like the credits. Like, when the movie ends, the story proper, credits roll on one side of the screen and then more content is great. Well, I just packed the credits. I said, because, you know, we overdid the credits because, let's be honest, you guys overpaid to see this movie. And stuff. So you eventize it. You turn it into something that's like an experience more so. Like, look, they're going to watch the movie streaming any minute, like when it comes out, and you can watch it everywhere and stuff. And so the kind of special aspect of, like, we're in a movie theater has slowly dissipated and gone away. So we just kind of keep it that. It's a party atmosphere, man. It's like
and
we built a time machine, and we take them all back to the 90s for 2 hours.
How important do you think, I mean, and it's funny because here you are the director, routinely director, writer, and star, but you're
thank you. You know, nobody ever says that, yeah. But it's true. I am the other guy in the title.
I know. So you're that. But in this case, too, the cult of Kevin Smith has helped create a fan base that is populating the theaters.
It's allowed me to do this in the first place.
Your podcasts, your shows, your general fandom has created, and it's all those sort of things that may not have been part of a master plan that look like a master plan now that we look back.
It's very, it was me desperate to stay in the game. Like,
yeah.
You know, because they introduce you. And even back then, it's like first-time filmmakers had what they call the sophomore slump or curse. Like, so you're introduced with a movie, and I had, like, the Cinderella story of a movie, Clerks. Then the next movie came out, was Mallrats, and, like, now everybody loves it. Then nobody liked it. The
right.
critics hated it. It died at the box office. And so everyone was like, this is what happens when you give these Sundance kids money and stuff. So I had no plan. It was more about staying alive. Chasing Amy was made partly because I was like, I have a story to tell. And partly because I was like, if we don't make something good, we're done. Like,
yeah.
They liked Clerks. They didn't like Mallrats. Let's try to make something that they like again. And that was Chasing Amy. And it saved us for like a long time. That was the movie that was an umbrella where people were like, yeah, he's done a lot of stupid things. But that Chasing Amy. And yet Chasing Amy has aged in a way that, like, for some audiences, that movie's problematic. Something we address in this movie and stuff. For a younger generation that didn't grow up with it and see the movie as like, oh, that was a movie that was helpful for a bunch of people at a time.
Sure.
There was no movie for that.
Yep.
Suddenly they look at the movie and they're like, you can't say things like that. How
yeah,
are you? You know, you're a cis white male. You shouldn't be telling the story.
I rewatched it recently, Chasing Amy, and I love it. It's a great movie. But, man, is it dated in some of its terminology?
It's very slut-shaming.
It is.
Like, that's
yeah.
what the movie kind of is about at its center.
And, but you have to judge things in their time.
Oh, yeah. Steve, you're talking to the internet. That's,
yeah,
they'll
yeah.
never do that. Like, what, are you crazy?
No.
That's not going to happen. So,
what was I
saying? It's weird to see it go through a filter where that was a movie for a long time that was like, that's my shield.
Yeah.
And now it's no longer the shield. Now Dogma is the shield, oddly enough.
Yeah.
Dogma's aged to this place where people are like, oh, I love that movie, man. I remember seeing that with my family and blah, blah, blah. It has more to do with their experience in seeing with the movie than the movie itself I've discovered over the years. Like, I'm tied in genetically to the DNA of the audience for a lot of people who are like, I met my wife and we went to see Clerks for the first time. My daughter is named Brody. You know, like, Jay and Silent Bob, we went to see that movie.
Right.
It took us 4 hours to drive there. There's always some experience surrounding it and stuff. And so the audience is incredibly ardent. They're not just like a casual film audience. It's like, oh, I like movies and stuff. When you're into my stuff, you're like really into it because it's been a part of your journey for like 25 years. Or then you meet people who are like 19 and you were like, man, you know where you were when we made that movie? Like in somebody's testicles. That's how long ago we made that movie.
You talk about the onus of that when you're in that part of your career. I need my umbrella film now to pull me back up.
Oh, that's not even for the part of it. That's been my entire career.
Are you bereft of that now? Is that something because you have an entrenched fan base that will, from the most part, support what you're doing?
Right. Yes and no.
Yes,
because I mean, we did Yoga Hosers, and they didn't show up for that at all.
Right.
So they're a wonderful audience, but they won't go for everything.
Yeah.
They're not just blindly loyal.
You can't take it for granted.
No, not at all. And they've let me know that in the past. But this one, I figured like, oh come on, this is the one that's in their DNA. Like Jay and Silent Bob have been there since the beginning, since Clerks 25 years ago, and they were in that movie. So I figured this might work out, and so far it has. And that has everything to do with their fondness for the early flicks. I'm so curious how this movie would work if you've never seen any of the other flicks.
Okay.
It might be strange for people going like, why? Who are all these people? Why do they know? Why is Ben Affleck in this movie? Why is Thor in this movie? You know, like people not quite understanding how it all fits together.
Speaking of
Affleck, was it Red Man that we had in here?
He said
the scene with Ben.
No, it was Donnell Rawlings.
It was Donnell Rawlings.
Donnell, yeah.
that the scene with Affleck, he said, was so profound to him. He almost couldn't.
He started like welling up.
He started
like a dad.
Yeah,
he
yeah.
loves being a dad, relishes that title. And the whole movie, Reboot, is about being a parent at its root level. Like, right. remove the jokes and everything. It's kind of about being what it's like to be a parent to some degree. And he is in that moment right now. He has an incredible relationship with his son. So I could see when he saw that scene, it impacted hard. Ben has this real, like, kind of big monologue, page-long monologue about what it's like to be a parent.
How, right.
Like, when you're a parent, you're no longer the star, you're the stage, and how it goes from your story to somebody else's story. You don't get a third act to your story because you're like, now this is the real story. I was just the opener and stuff. Oh. And so all of that stuff really hits hard if you're a parent, even if a parent of a 20-year-old, but when you're the parent of a small kid and you actually love that small kid like Donnell does with his kid, the movie hits you right in the feels big time. That's the thing. Like, we made a funny movie like we had to. It was a sequel to a comedy, so it better be funny. But the thing nobody was looking for and asked for, but the thing that everyone seems to like the most about the movie is it has all the feels. Like, there's moments in the movie where you will actually roll a tear, and not because you're like, they ruined it, man. They ruined Jay Buck. It's because Jay's performance will get you there. It's his finest hour in, like, 25 years. It's an absolute showcase for him. And, you know, as a guy who's been working with him for a quarter of a century, as a guy who started practically puppeteering him with a hand up his butt going like, snooch to the nooch, I've watched him grow into, like, his own actor. Like, it's kind
of another example of a guy who we thought was at that precipice and about to tip over and has pulled it back with Herculean ability.
You know who noticed that big time is Ben. When Ben came down to shoot the scene in the movie, he hadn't been around us in close to, like, 10 years.
Right.
And the last time he saw Jason, Jason was circling the drain. And Ben had just kind of been like, well, that's it for Jay.
Hmm.
So he steps back into our world, and it's a completely different Jason Mewes, who's, like, been sober for going on 10 years now, married, and, like, the world's best dad. The dude is legit wonderful dad. And Ben experienced that firsthand because there's Jason on set with his kid, and Jason's way more interested in his kid than making the movie and stuff. And Ben was blown away by it. He's like, did you know Muse has been clean for almost 10 years? I was like, I didn't leave. Yes, I was here. I watched that 10 years. So it's really nice that, like, he stepped back in, and his admiration for Jay went over the moon. Like, he was sitting there quizzing him on, how do you do this? Like,
because he's had his own issues.
His own issues.
Yeah.
And, like, he was kind of inspired by Jay's ability to keep it together, because he was always the guy least likely. This was the kid we'd all make fun of.
Yeah.
Because he was Captain Irresponsibility. You wouldn't trust him with a carton of eggs, let alone a human being and stuff. And yet there's Jay being a great dad.
Not to change topics, but how you know, because I have a follow-up question here. How were you as a student growing up, like a high school student?
I was not, like, great.
What about your English classes?
I could have applied myself, but I didn't. I was okay with B's and C's.
Okay, because your
English is where I excelled, though. Writing was my bag.
Your ability to tell a story, you know, not just on paper and on film, but, you know, here just talking is
exemplary.
It is, and I can't think of the word exemplary. But, like, even when you said, you know, Jay was circling the drain for a little bit, I'm like, has he ever used that before? Like, what a great metaphor. I'm 44. I've never heard that as a metaphor.
Circling the drain? Yeah.
Never. Yeah, well, I mean,
we were talking
that means you've never encountered anybody. You're circling the drain, and that's a positive thing.
Yeah,
but when you know them where you're like, we thought we lost him so many times. And in the beginning, I was the one who'd throw out a net and be like, we got to save him because he's got $1 million heart, nickel head, but $1 million heart and stuff. But he eventually started saving himself. And he did that for almost 10 years with the podcast with Jay and Silent Bob Get Old. And that's kind of where Reboot comes out of that. And but what saves him now is the kid.
Yeah.
He won't ever let that kid down. Him and that kid are, like, best friends.
It's so good to hear that. We had a conversation yesterday about role models and whether what we define as a role model and what or just people who give you inspiring messages. I look at your life. I look at on a creative level. Ever since you came on the scene, I'm like, that guy's got it. That guy.
God,
that guy. That he's.
I've met all the other people who are like, that guy don't belong here. Why is that guy still doing this?
But you. I never for a second. I thought that you were always doing it for the purity of the love of everything you're involved with. And I said, if you can get to that point, That's it.
If you can, the money thing is the thing that everyone focuses on, right? Because with this line of work, supposedly vast riches. And I'm not going to deny that, like, you get overpaid to do things that you would do normally.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when we're not touring the movie, him and I just sit on stage and talk to each other about old movies.
Yeah.
And people overpay to come see us do that. That's why I was like, boy, if we brought him a new movie, you know, that would be kind of cool.
Sure.
So the relationship with the audience is incredibly symbiotic. I only get to be the guy who's like, oh, he's doing everything he likes to do because the audience will kind of support me, at least to a large degree. So that has allowed me to, like, not have a traditional career. Like, if I was doing it right, I would have done one thing for the last 25 years and really tried to improve upon it. Like, people in my line of work try to win Oscars and stuff.
But I think you have sort of a creativity ADD.
Very much so. Yeah. It's like you see, Homer sees the dog and he's like, ooh, a puffy tail. Like, you get very right. distracted easily because you see people doing things that appeal to you. Like, you guys doing this is always, like, gets my blood going. That's why, like, we went to bed at 3 in the morning, but I'm here, like, I got up at 6 to be here at 7 because, like, this is what I'd rather do than anything else. Oh, like, awesome. You guys have the dream job. You don't have to shower if you don't want to. You know, the stars come to you. They need you. You don't have to be like, please, man, please, I need you to do me a favor and stuff. And you get to talk. Yeah. You don't have to sit there and build some visual scheme and stuff and lie to people with pictures. You get here and you get to be honest and stuff. That's why I dove into podcasting, because I'm like, that's like having a radio show without having a radio show. Oh, my Lord. So I get distracted by other people's jobs. Like, I started going up on stage because I loved Carlin and what he did. I was like, what would it be like to be up there on stage?
None better.
I started making films because Richard Linklater, Ray Slackers, what would that be like to do that sort of thing? I started doing podcasts because I grew up listening to Stern. I was like, what would it be like if I was Stern? Like, yeah. Just talking about my life. So I get very easily distracted. I have no qualms about it. I'm never, like, regretful, like, oh, I should have done this. I always feel like every once in a while I'll do something where I'm like, this satisfies the urge, scratches the itch of could I have been? What should I have done? Because you never know if you've done your life correctly. And in my case, like, I made one movie and I was only expected to do that, and it turned into a career. So I've been, like, playing catch up ever since and whatnot. So periodically it occurs to me, like when Joker came out, I was like, you know, I've been into this crap for a long time, man. Like, should I have been on top of this? Like, not should I have made Joker, but, like, should I have made a comic book movie by now? I've been talking about it for years and stuff. And then I looked back at my career and like, what would I trade up? Everything I did, I desperately wanted to do. And even if it didn't work out, that was the thing I most wanted to do.
You don't need to make a comic book movie. What you've done, and I see you as one of the front runners in the birth of geek culture becoming what it is
and
now.
And the acceptance of.
And your connection to it, even though you didn't directly do comic book movies, it was always an undercurrent, and it always had, and it always labeled it up, brought it up to a hipper, cooler level that us as nerds, and thank you, by the way, you know, we love you. You love that we get to do this type of thing.
Yes.
You give us stuff to talk about. And that was a big
only
part.
For one morning out of like 365.
We reference you all the time.
But I'm talking about geek culture in general because we love it, and we could go on forever about it.
The world did start circulating or turning in the direction of the stuff I liked. I just got very lucky in that, in as much as 25 years ago, I was like, comic books and movies about comic books. And like, we live in a culture now where that is the culture. Like in Mallrats, we had Stan Lee, and we were like, hey, imagine if everybody knew who Stan Lee was, and like they did in the movie. Now,
they do.
That's the case.
I'm an example of that. I didn't know who Stan Lee was, really, until Mallrats. And I was a fan of yours, and then I was a fan of that movie because we all got around, like you were talking about experiential things. We got around, and we watched that movie over and over in college, and I loved Mallrats. And then I loved Kevin Smith, and then I loved Stan Lee. And then, because of these guys, I fell in love with Marvel movies, you know, and so now
he had to. It's a job requirement.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, good.
But the fact that it came full circle for you with Stan Lee in the movie, holding the script of Mallrats, to me that means something. And I don't even really know you, but like that was so cool to see all of that come full circle.
It was almost like, you know, years ago when we made Mallrats, we put the scene in with Stan, and it was almost telling a younger audience, "Hey, for those of you that don't know, this is the guy that created Spider-Man. This is Stan Lee. Yeah. He's a legend.
And he's just talking about love.
And being that guy that brings people together. Years later, he returned the favor by holding up that Mallrat script. He was like, hey, here's a guy you probably don't know, Kevin Smith. So it really does come full circle. But I've never honestly like have regret about paths not taken. Like I sit there. Like, remember that movie, The Freshman?
Love it.
So there's a moment in the movie The Freshman's got Marlon Brando and Matthew Broderick.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Matthew Broderick's in college, and Marlon Brando goes to visit him at college. He's in the dorm. I really don't remember the movie, but this moment crystallized for me and still sticks in my head. He's sitting there in the doorway, and he's talking about something unrelated to college. And then just before he leaves the scene, Marlon Brando looks around. And he goes, so this is college. I didn't miss anything. And he leaves. That's how I feel from time to time. Like, every once in a while, I do something that is mainstream or something that feels like, oh, this is what you would do if you were being smart about your career. Like, when I made Red State, I was like, see? Like, I can do it. I can make a good movie. I just choose not to every time. I choose to make a Kevin Smith movie instead.
But if you look at the and again, I'm a big fan of this notion of sometimes you step out of the way and let the fluidity of life proceed. So as all this is going on and you've never made your superhero movie, what happens? DC blows up on television.
The whole world is making superhero movies.
And who do they come to direct some episodes? It's you. So
I got to do some CW stuff.
Yeah.
That was very cool. And that definitely made me go, oh, okay, like if I ever wanted to work with people in funny costumes outside of my stuff, this covers it. But it also reminds me why I never try to make a big budget comic book movie and stuff. Yeah. Those episodes shoot in 8 days. Wow. In 8 days, you're done with your 42-page script. And usually by day five, I'm like, are we still doing this? Like, I just get bored very easily.
Right,
and those movies take a long time. And it's all about, like, we shot half a page of dialogue today. And, like, I'm used to shooting 5-7 pages of dialogue and stuff. So, it's not me going, like, I'm too brilliant. I'd have to throttle down. But, like, I don't have the patience or, let's be honest, the visual acumen to pull that kind of stuff off. My version of a superhero movie, like in Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, we have a little scene from Blunt Man v. Chronic. All they do is sit around and talk to each other. Nobody fights. There's no action whatsoever.
Right.
In my, you know, action movie, in my comic book movie, they'd probably sit around and talk about Star Wars for half an hour. So that's not really like the field that I should be in, but Lord knows I appreciate it like crazy. And people are like, when are you going to make one of these? I'm like, I ain't in it to make one of these. I'm in it to enjoy these. Like, this is the place where I get to be an audience member. You know, Martin Scorsese fairly recently was like, this is not cinema.
We were talking about it.
He's absolutely entitled to his opinion. He's a genius, and he built cinema almost single-handedly. But that being said, Martin Scorsese probably, like if I said to him, musicals aren't cinema, Martin Scorsese gave me an eloquent argument about why they were. Why? Because he grew up with his parents going to musicals and stuff. He made one himself, New York, New York. And to him, oh my God, musicals are definitely a part of the cinematic fabric and stuff. He didn't grow up going to Marvel movies. He didn't grow up going to action movies like I did with my dad. Like when I go to a Marvel movie, I see what they're doing, but I also feel like, oh, this is like when I went to see Empire Strikes Back. This feels like when I went to see Raiders of the Lost Ark for the first time with my old man. And for those movies to like summon up the dead, because when I watch a Marvel movie, it's like my old man sitting there with me. I get the same feeling.
I know that feeling.
That's absolute cinema. That's the very definition of cinema and stuff. So I love those, but I don't want to make those. Like I'm happy to be an audience member for that. Like it's just because I work in the movie field doesn't mean I got to make every kind of movie there is. And making a movie like that takes a specialized talent and stuff. So that's where I turn off. I'm a filmmaker and turn on. I'm the audience again. It allows me to go back to a place that I honestly never thought I'd be able to return to. Once you know how the sausage is made, how on earth are you supposed to enjoy sausage ever again? But when I watch those Marvel movies, I don't even know how they make the sausage. I'm like, just keep giving it to me. Kill those pigs. The vegan goes crazy for those Marvel movies.
Speaking of being in the audience, we had a quick conversation before you came on about the Watchmen
movies.
And before,
amazing.
When the teasers were coming, I was just like, I was saying silent prayers. Please do it right. Please do it right. Please do it right.
We were both like, this can go either way so quickly.
I watched the first episode 3 times in 2 days. I
watched it multiple times.
This is phenomenal.
I told my wife, and she doesn't get into like the superhero stuff. She loves Regina King, and she loves Southland. I was like, then you have to watch this because it's a cop show. And she's like, it's about superheroes. I was like, no, they wear masks. There's a big difference.
Yeah.
It's absolutely brilliant. I remember when they announced it, I was like, oh, great. They're going to do Watchmen the right way. They're going to do like a 12 episode maxi series and stuff. And then they were like, no, it's a sequel series. And I'm like, a sequel? Wait, to the movie or to the books?
Right.
Because not, you know, some people knew the movie, but not everyone knows the books. And how are you going to do that? And then he starts saying all these things like, I'm trying to make it feel tonally like it felt to me as I read The Watchmen for the first time. And I'm like, that's an intriguing idea, but how are you going to pull it off? They're literally pulling it off. As I watch every episode, it does have that same feeling of discovery as when I was watching Watchmen. It's incredibly smart, very clever, but very relatable as well. Every one of those instances, I mean, number one, the whole thing's predicated on a real life incident that, like, most of us didn't even know about. So great entertainment can not only entertain you, but educate you as well. So we all learned about the Tulsa Massacre and stuff. And then they built what most people would consider at one point or another disposable comic book culture, comic book story on a historical incident, and made The Watchmen about something real. It's about race relations, for heaven's sake. I didn't see that coming. They didn't tip that at all. And suddenly you're like, look, I came for this, and you guys gave me this. So I'm sticking around, man. Mm-hmm. Oh, it is fantastic. Like you said, I've watched every episode multiple times. I don't do that for other things.
Right.
But I got to get into it. I'm looking at the details. And he is nailing it. He is capturing the feeling of what it was like to read that book. Now, I love Damon. I've interviewed him on one of our shows. He was on Spoilers and stuff.
This is Damon Lindelof.
Damon Lindelof, the creator of the show. But, you know, Damon also has a history of getting you to a place where you're like, this is brilliant, and then dropping the ball. And then, what about the smoke monster?
Thank you.
Utter faith that he's going to pull it off. Like, it means the world to him. This is part of the stuff that sends him on his creative journey to make him the show creator that he winds up being. I think he's going to honor it right to the end. And
I think because he has a structure and a lore.
But he doesn't. Think about it.
Well, like, I know. He's going off into virgin territory.
He's doing his own thing.
Yeah, but there are certain constraints that he's going to have to stick to.
What are those? Really nothing. Think in the first three episodes of the show, they're completely untethered from the book.
I guess you're right, yeah.
And he is kind of creating his own thing. So at this point, because I thought about the same thing. I was like, oh, well, now that Damon has some structure, of course he's making like something that you can watch from beginning to end. But I thought about it. I was like, no, there's no structure. He's not going off of like, well, it has to be like this because this was in the book. He's free form, but he's found a discipline to tell this story, which is translating to people that don't even like stuff like this.
Yeah.
People who they've never read Watchmen. They can enjoy this thing. And it will in turn send them back to Watchmen to read it. And suddenly you've got a bunch of new comic book readers for an industry that always needs help. That's a great thing.
What do you think Alan Moore would think of?
I wonder off the top. For those that don't know, Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons created The Watchmen. Moore wrote and Dave Gibbons drew. Alan Moore has since, long time ago, taken his name off The Watchmen when it's in another medium. So if you buy The Watchmen graphic novel, it says written by Alan Moore. If you see anything like The Watchmen movie or now The Watchmen TV series, it says based on the book by Dave Gibbons. Alan Moore's name's not on it. Alan Moore is famously like anti-movies of his films. Yeah. He's not anti-movies. He seems to love movies. But he's like, these things that I've written, they're not meant for other mediums, and I can't stand when they try to translate them.
So V for Vendetta, he was out on that,
He was out on that. He's never been in on any of them stuff. So,
who was the tracer for that?
Gibbons was his own tracer. He did it all. So Dave Gibbons is now the face of Watchmen outside of comic books in the medium and stuff. So as I watched the show, you know, Damon said before the show started, he was like, you know, Alan probably hates us and stuff. Never thought about it until I was on episode 3, and I was like, I wonder what he would think of this. Like, would he respect the spirit of it? Something tells me that, and I don't know him, I've never met Alan Moore, but I've just read a bunch of interviews, but it would be something along the lines, if I had to guess, of like, look, this is great, this Watchmen show. Why call it Watchmen?
Yeah.
Like, call it anything else. Right. It's really not related to what I did and stuff. And I could see that point of view, but like, that show is made by an ardent fan who their life was changed by that source material. And he's smart enough, Damon, to not go like, I'm going to adapt The Watchmen, because then that puts you in trouble. Like with a bunch of people playing, it ain't as good as the book. But he took the feeling of that book and created a brand new thing. I got to imagine on some level, Alan Moore would like that. I don't know.
He would. He maybe would not admit it. But I was thinking exactly the same
thing. As a storyteller,
it probably gets closer to something he might give a slight nod to.
More so than like when they in DC did the Before Watchmen series, where they were doing books that were based on the characters before the stories, and some of them were really great. But yeah. That is something that treads on canon. Yeah. So you run the risk of like offending somebody. This doesn't tread on canon. In fact. It adheres to canon more than Zack Snyder's movie did, and as much as it deals with the squid. It talks about the giant squid.
Right.
And that was a big part of the book. So I got to think, on some level, if he ever bothered to give it a role or something, as a storyteller, I think he'd be like, well done.
Some great stuff. I mean, and you talk about The Phantom. We were huge fans of the series, The Boys.
Oh, my God.
Which
is so good.
I saw you going off on that. And
that was one of those shows where I was like, should I have made this? You know, like, this is right up my alley.
I mean, from beginning to end, thunders. And it's one of those ones, a lot of times when I get out of the gate and people go, you should check this out.
I wasn't even familiar with the source material. I had no idea. It came out of nowhere. I watched this show and I'm like, oh my God. The first 10 minutes, I'm like, I'm in.
By the time they get to the sequence where Homelander and Maeve are on the plane. And
oh my God.
Spoilers if you don't want to know, but they're like, we can't save these people.
Yep.
I've never seen that scene in comics. I've never seen it in the movies. Like,
it's so true. It's incredibly gripping. It takes a weird, okay, so we're going to buy that they can do this, but for them to say, and it's a question we've all asked, what is he pushing off against?
That's what he said. He was just like, what am I leaning against?
How am I lifting this plane up if I'm not, how am I, and all those things.
And he was just so, like, kind of cold and logical
and
about it.
And
then when
he turns
on the people,
yeah,
that's like, that was gripping as heck when he was just like, back off, and his eyes light up and stuff. And then you realize, like, all these people are going to die.
Yep.
Oh, it was nuts. So well done. I watched that scene 5 times. I kept going back on, they did not.
Yeah.
This is compelling. Scenes like that make me, as a storyteller, go like, I give up.
Oh, wow.
I can't be that good.
When you go back and rewatch, what are you doing?
I'm looking for performance beats.
Okay.
I'm looking for dialogue because I want to hear the lines that led up to the moment.
I mean,
is
this
like, if there's anything I missed to get to that conclusion.
Is this like dissecting a football play? I mean,
probably. Okay. Like play by play where they go back and they start doing X's and O's on the screen.
All right, let me see
what
the left tackle's doing.
Same
here.
Same thing here, because as a storyteller, I'm like, that blew me away. I want to know how that just happened. So I'll go back and watch it and be like, damn. And, you know, it's not normally just that one scene. Of course, you've got to go back throughout the entire series to earn a moment like that. Like, there were a couple episodes prior to that, and then suddenly that scene has way more impact.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about Watchmen and Boys and X-Men. As a writer, at what point in your life and your career did you really begin to understand allegory and thinking about, hey, this is not just about superheroes, this is about outcasts? And
I got to be honest with you, until you brought it up, I don't think I've ever thought of that.
We just had an epiphany here.
Early on, my old man was he was a big reader. So at the end of the day, when I'd be reading comics, you know, he'd be like, well, that's not just about that.
Yeah. Yeah. My mom's an English teacher. And so she would point these things out to me. I'm like, no.
Yes.
Oh, wait. Yeah, you're smarter than me.
All it takes is an erudite parent, somebody who's just a little smarter than you or a lot smarter than you. And with enough free time and inclination to be like, well, I'm going to knock this kid's socks off.
Yeah.
Spider-Man is an allegory for all of us. And you're like, what?
Yeah. They're actually teaching. I brought my son to St. Joe's Prep. It's a high school in the area. And senior English, they are taught Watchmen. Like, it is required reading.
That makes me so happy
to
hear. Because, number one, it's quality reading material.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, you can dissect that and learn a bunch about it. Number three, it has history in it as well, mm-hmm. because he kind of set it in a historical era with Reagan and stuff. Yeah. I can see that absolutely working. Like, look, I'm not thumbing my nose at the classics, but I was made to read some really boring crap when I was in school.
Johnny Tremaine?
Yes. If they handed me The Watchmen, I'd be like, I'm in. More reading like this.
Yep.
It is true.
Question. Do you have to take off right away?
Let me take a look at my...
5 hours, 18 minutes from here to Logan International. So
is that what it is?
Yeah.
Is your event at the airport?
Yeah, we're doing it right there. As planes come in, we'll be having a performance on the runway.
Because we do have to take a break.
I'm being here until like 8:30.
I love it. Kevin Smith in our studio. We'll be back in just a moment.
That's your traffic on 93.3 WMMR.
Kevin Smith is here, and we're talking about Jay and Silent Bob reboot and whatever else we feel like talking about.
I was just thinking of, like, growing up listening to the radio, listening to, like, the traffic report, that stuff gets embedded in your head. Like you are somebody's childhood right now. You don't know it. You sit there rattling off the traffic and whatnot, but, like, somewhere some kid is just like, I live for that traffic report.
One day I'll do traffic.
When they grow up and when they hear your voice, they'll be like, that is the sound of a happy child. It's really kind of amazing. You mentioned King of Prussia Mall. This is not really a story, but like, I think I might have told you guys, I'm not sure, but my sister went to Cabrini.
Oh,
so okay. I spent a lot of time in the area from 1983 to 1987. I went to a Cabrini arts camp as a punishment one year. it was the sweetest punishment I ever had, but my parents like caught me in the house. They went to Atlantic City, and I had a girl over, and they came home, and the girl was there and said,
you're going to arts
school. You're getting out of here, man. We're sending you to your sister's, and you're going to arts camp for the summer. And I was like, oh, okay. And I was a kid who liked acting, so like I really fell in love with it and stuff. So I spent a bunch of time in the area, including King of Prussia Mall. So the day Ghostbusters comes out, we go see Ghostbusters at King of Prussia Mall, and there was a Bennigan's there.
Yes.
Okay. We go to Bennigan's right after, and on the menu, for the first time ever in my life, I see mozzarella sticks.
Oh.
This is the era when the mozzarella stick was introduced into restaurants.
It just premiered.
Kids, like, you're like, come on, that's always been around. There was a time where there was, just like there was a time there was no salsa, there was a time where there was no mozzarella stick. Hey. And I remember, like, going, what is that? And they told me, and my mom's like, mozzarella is cheese. It's what they put on pizza. And I was like, can we get some of these? And we got mozzarella sticks. And for 30 years, I assumed that those were the first mozzarella sticks ever sold in America because they were my first.
Yeah.
I was like, I was there when they introduced mozzarella sticks in Bennigan's in Philadelphia area back in the 80s.
And people looked at me
like, what are you, nuts? And I'm like, well, I guess it was my first experience. But whenever I hear about King of Prussia, I think about, oh, that was where we discovered mozzarella sticks. That's where I saw Ghostbusters.
Right.
You can tell there's a fat kid buried in me because I'm like, that's where I first ate cheese.
Have you ever been back to Cabrini? My brother went there.
Went to Cabrini?
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord. I love that school. I didn't go there. She did, but she went 4 years, and I got to spend a lot of time there. When I went for that summer to be punished, like I was staying with my sister, she was staying at the dorms. So I was living with a bunch of women, well, lady, you know, girls, because they were like 19, 20, but yeah, I was 13, 14, all summer long, man. And they all treated me like a little brother. None of them were like, hey, let's have sex. That would have been amazing. But they all, that would have been, oh, could you imagine? I would have told my parents I was so punished this summer. But they all,
you
would have
robbed
like,
the liquor store.
Like, my sister had a boyfriend, so she was busy and stuff. So the rest of them would take me out. So they took me to see, like, Bachelor Party. They took me to all R-rated movies that summer. It was so wonderful. But I did hope that one of them would, like, fall in love with me and be like, nobody's here. Let's go for it. Never happened.
Never.
Never
you know,
happened.
You remember those? You just mentioned Bachelor Party, and we had Adrian Zmed in here.
Oh, my Lord. He's so good in that movie.
He was a great
TJ Hooker's Adrian Zmed.
Absolutely. And he was exactly what you want. You know, as Quentin Tarantino started to, by the way, he loves Red State, you know, as you well know.
Oh, good.
As he starts to incorporate people from his, you know, from his childhood days, or those pivotal people. Do you still have people on the, I've got to put them in a movie list?
Oh, my God, yes. I would love to work with Robert Shaw, who played Quentin Jaws, but he's dead. Yeah. He's been dead for about 40 years.
If you could pull it off.
Well, I don't know. They're bringing back James Dean.
Yes.
So it's possible we get Robert Shaw. That?
Robert Shaw, by the way, I'm wearing the shirt from Rush with Love, and he plays Grant, the assassin in that. And he is sensational.
He's wonderful. And he's always great. My favorite role of his, other than Jaws, we know him as Quentin and stuff. If you're a movie person and you haven't seen it, check out A Man for All Seasons, where he plays Henry VIII. And he's got, you know, a five-minute scene, but it's so tour de force and bravura that he steals the movie out from under Paul Scofield for, like, that period of time. Because he's like a child. It's crazy. He reminds you, you know, of some political figures that we have to deal with sometimes. He goes from 0 to 60, where he's, like, calmly rational, and then suddenly he's screaming like a child. It's such a great performance.
And he was a great playwright, by the way.
Yes, he wrote a play as well. I have the one that he wrote. He wrote a few, but I've got one that he wrote at home that Betty Aberlin had given me, but Lady Aberlin.
Wow.
Mr. Rogers?
Mr. Rogers. Yeah, she's been in a bunch of our flicks and stuff. She was first one in was Dogma. She's the nun in the very beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
She came into audition. I was like, is this Lady Aberlin?
No, like, way.
You don't have to audition. You're hired. So I've put her in stuff ever since. We just did this movie. Kilroy was here that we shot with a bunch of college students. That'll come out later. But the question about
other people in your list.
James Dean.
James Dean.
Yeah.
Here's my question. I mean, like, if you got technology, go for it, I guess. But, like, is anybody going like, man, I'd pay to see a James Dean movie right now? Like, when you cast a star in a movie, you're doing it because that star is going to bring a bunch of people into the audience. Most of James Dean's audience has passed away.
Yeah.
Like, he was an old movie star.
Right.
Or fairly old. I just don't know who this would be for then.
Is it so? Is it based so like with The Irishman? They've done a lot of that de-aging stuff that right. they did
to us. This is more like Peter Cushing's
right.
yep.
Avatar in Rogue One.
Right.
So or Carrie Fisher's, where it's like, these people aren't here, but we're skinning them like a Sims character on another actor. So you'll get to watch them act again.
There's a weirdness
weird
to it.
You're not watching that person act at all.
Yeah.
But Marlon Brando was way into it. Marlon Brando had himself scanned, and he was like, this is the future. I'm going to be in movies long after I'm dead. So, you know, on a certain point, like on the ego level, perhaps James Dean would have appreciated being resurrected. But he, I never met the guy and stuff, but anything I've read or saw about him over the years didn't really indicate that he was the kind of guy that was like, I'm a populist. Right. Like, put me in every movie and stuff like that. Put me in a Marvel movie. I'll play Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So I it seems kind of weird.
Well, maybe
disrespectful. I don't know. Like, this guy, I saw a tweet online that I thought was hysterical. They were like, we asked James Dean for his comment on being resurrected for a movie, and it was just a photo of a pile of bones. You know, like, so James Dean obviously has no opinion on the matter, but, like, I don't know. If he doesn't, why should I?
There's no algorithm that can replicate his acting abilities.
Absolutely.
So what you're getting is basically a visual...
Somebody doing an impression.
Yeah.
A performance.
Yeah.
Like, essentially... remember Philip Seymour Hoffman played Capote?
Yeah.
That's what you're getting, but somebody putting a skin on top of it so it looks exactly
right.
like Capote. So, I mean, interesting in an uncanny valley kind of way, and maybe that makes a few people go to the movie theater. But honestly, like, wouldn't you be more inclined to go if they're like, we got a CG Tom Hanks?
Yeah.
And they're like, wait, but Tom Hanks is around. Like, yeah, but we built a CG one. I guess that's what Polar Express was.
It is. Yeah. And that was, talk about that Uncanny Valley.
And that creeped everyone out. Yeah.
So with deepfakes and the stuff that they're starting to, and you're always aware. Like, for example, in Rogue One, which it was just such an emotionally wonderful thing to see a young Princess Leia going right. seconds away from going into Episode 4 was great at the end of that. But with some of the deepfakes are so good.
Yeah.
Like, they did a series where Jim Carrey inserted for Jack Nicholson in The Shining. And you will sit there and there's virtually nothing that will indicate it wasn't that. As a filmmaker, I mean, while it just to me seems like it's a gimmick. I don't
huge
see any
gimmick.
Other application.
It's a special effect, just like any special effect. And when used accordingly, you know, could really satisfy an audience and stuff. But when used... not accordingly, it creates what they call the uncanny valley effect, where you're looking at it going like, yeah, it looks real, but something's wrong.
Something's wrong.
I know something's wrong with it. We saw one, you know, Ralph Garman, who I do Hollywood Babylon with, a Philadelphian Ralph Garman.
He's great.
He does a Stallone impression, which is pretty damn good. Somebody deepfaked a video of us, and they put Stallone's face on Ralph, and it's crazy. Like, all of a sudden, I was like, when did I sit next to Stallone? But, it's somebody just working with zeros and ones and pixels to kind of create an image they want. It's pretty astounding, but I can't see this is the future. I can't see, like, they're like, hey, man, now Marilyn Monroe's back as well.
It's interesting, but I think there's also some other potentially really incredible actors out there that can build up legends of their own. May want to try them as well.
You know what I'm saying? Like, how about acting is for the living?
Yeah.
Like, you only get a small time on this planet.
Right, right.
And if you're lucky, like, you have to go through a zillion gauntlets to become, like, some movie star that people know and stuff. You know, James Dean, he had his time.
He enjoyed three pictures that he's known for, and they're classics.
And long after his death, people are still like, hey, James Dean, he's an icon and stuff.
And now he's
I don't think we need to, like, puppeteer him like Weekend at Bernie's.
I mean, I'm not chomping at the bit to go see this movie. But I want to ask you, so the show has become friendly and friends with Michael Giacchino, composer.
What a wonderful composer. The modern day, I mean, nobody wants to, I'm sure you don't want to hear this, but he's like the modern day Danny Elfman. There's a period where Danny Elfman was the guy everybody went to.
Yeah.
And right now it's Michael Giacchino.
So Nick has struck up a really great relationship with him. And as they were scoring Spider-Man Homecoming. Mm-hmm. These guys got to go into the studio and watch it. Watch
with
it
a full orchestra and stuff?
Oh, my God.
Isn't that astounding?
It was unbelievable.
Yeah, it's astounding incredible. When you see a full orchestra, period, and they're making music, because you're like, there's so much talent. But when they make music where you're like, that's the Spider-Man theme. Yeah. You're like, oh, this is a great use of millions of dollars.
And they hadn't rehearsed at all, and they're just picking up the sheet music, and then
they do
go.
It on the first shot every time.
We did that. We had a full orchestra, oddly enough, on Dogma. Well, that made sense because that was Howard Shore was the composer. The guy did Lord of the Rings and stuff.
Wow.
But we had it on. Jim Venable had a full orchestra on Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. So I remember we went to the day of record, and he had never worked with an orchestra. He was the Powerpuff Girls composer, so he was all synth and stuff. But we were like, hey, we're going to do the score. And the person who was in charge of the music was like, do you have a person that you like? And Jim had never done it before, and he just spit out, like, the most famous name he knew. And they're like, all right, we'll get that person. And then suddenly he had full orchestra. So his grandmother was still around, and he brought her to be able to see it. And, you know, that score I absolutely love, but it's Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. You know what I'm saying? It's not like, hey, this is the score for Schindler's List. You know, we're going to win Oscars. Yeah. And stuff. But to see a full orchestra playing these goofy cues, man, and having a good time, like they were all laughing because generally they play very serious music. And this was very Elmer Bernsteinian music in as much as it's meant to sound serious, but it's obviously played comedically. They enjoy themselves. Like you watch the people who are like paid session members who are used to like performing cracking up because they're like, oh, this is so stupid. Like, well, and having a good time with it. It's such a great experience being in a room for
we were there for about 8 or 10 hours. We were there for the whole session. And
you don't get bored, right?
No. I was kind of nervous being there and felt really out of place. And in fact, it went to a gazillion levels higher than that. After this guy came in, he sat down for a while, made some notes, said a couple things, and he left. And Nick goes, "That you know who was sitting next to us? It was Kevin Feige." And we're like, I didn't know that. And he made like a
the best Kevin in the world. The one Kevin we have to protect.
He made like a sweeping hand gesture that okayed a go-ahead on something that just cost oodles of cash about using a song. They were like, we can't find the right thing to do here. Can we just grab a song and use it, you know, from the catalog?
Needle
He's like,
drop.
Yeah. And we were like, later on, we're like, we're doing the money in our head. We're like, oh my God, he just made that decision like that.
Well, I saw your
print movie. Those Marvel movies are a bank. So at a certain point, they're like, spend it. We're going to get a bank.
Do it. Yeah. The soundtrack for Jane Silent Bob reboot just got a nod from, was it the LA Times or
LA Weekly? I think LA Weekly. Gave you the
soundtrack of the week.
Very sweet. We got lucky with reboot in as much as a lot of things. Like, I think because we've been around for a while, like, I've seen all ends of this business, including people being like, go away, you suck.
Yeah.
And now, post-Heart Attack, they're like, all right, you could stay. You lived. You're the boy who lived. And so there's enough nostalgia for the 90s, too, where people are like, hey, he's back. It culminated in this awesome thing like that I never saw coming, I was never trying for, and I never imagined would ever happen. Me and Jay put our handprints in the cement at the Chinese Theater Los Angeles. Grauman's Chinese Theater, now the TCL Man's Theater. That's the place where, you know, they got the famous handprints and stuff. We've got out in Los Angeles and Hollywood stars on the sidewalk and stuff. There are lots of those. We don't have one of those. But the rare space is the courtyard. And that's like truly Hollywood. I never thought we'd be in there because that's like Clint Eastwood's in there. Mm. The kids from Harry Potter.
Errol Flynn.
What's his name? Jimmy Durante with his nose pressed into it.
Marilyn Monroe.
Marilyn Monroe. Absolute legends. And then as time has gone on, they've added new legends and stuff. So Tom Cruise is in there. George Lucas. Steven Spielberg and stuff. But that was never going to be for us, particularly because we're not synonymous with Hollywood. We're very New Jersey. And we wound up getting our handprints and our feet in the cement like, what was it, a month ago. Wow. I flew my whole family out and stuff because in 1979, my old man, my mom, my brother, my sister and me, we went on a train ride, like cross country, went to Hollywood. They knew I was a big Hollywood fan and stuff. And my dad, like we were looking at the footprints, I got R2-D2, C-3PO, Darth Vader had just gone into the cement at that point. It was like 1979-80. And so my dad, like, were showing me, he's like, this one's this one, explaining who the people I don't know are. But I knew a lot of them because I was a big Hollywood fan and stuff. And the old man says something stupid that you say to kids, like, just, you know, pass the time, whatever. Not like, this is a seed, this is a plan, because we weren't from this world and stuff. But my old man goes, maybe you'll be here one day.
Wow. And
40 years from that moment, because that was in 1979. This is here we are, 2019. 40 years later, we were there in the courtyard. So my family was there. My dad's gone, but I brought my dad's ashes with me. So for the first time, we were all together. There they are in my hand. And then, like, right before we left, like there was a little space next to my handprint, so I took my old man's ashes, see the circle there?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
pushed it into the cement.
Awesome.
So he's there as well. Wow. I mean, he brought us there. And,
that's amazing.
I can't imagine. Like, my mom was blown away. Affleck was there. He was he read for us, like, and my kid read for us as well. And Affleck, before we went, he was like, I cannot believe that you two are getting this done before me. And I was like, I know, Batman. I don't know what to tell you. So it was incredibly special. And that was something that really felt like I was never going for that.
Yeah.
That's like beyond a dream.
Yeah.
Like a dream is something you don't get to attain.
That's
and
a pinnacle.
In the courtyard,
that, yeah, that's
never.
A pinnacle Hollywood. That is a, that if you want to talk about, and you're right, you represent
I was done
the ultimate Hollywood
point.
Outsider.
Yeah.
At being, there's no bigger embrace of someone than that. That is old, old Hollywood.
It was warm and wonderful. And it was, somebody asked me, Ashley, my old assistant, she was like, how do you feel? And I said, like, the best word I could describe it is safe.
Yeah.
I, for the first time in 25 years of my career, I feel safe because you're always struggling to stay relevant. You're always struggling to make something. You're always struggling to be like there in their face. Like, you don't get a career like mine when you don't have oodles of talent like a Tom Cruise or a Tom Hanks or Steven Spielberg and stuff. You don't get a career like mine unless you live in everyone's face.
Yeah.
Like, I'm more of a fan of the audience than the audience is of me. And Clerks is a word that I've said every day for the last 25 years. So, like, I definitely stayed diligent in my career, but I never imagined that we'd be a part of that. And that made me feel safe. For the first time in 25 years, I was like, all right, we can breathe. Like, I'm here. I ain't going anywhere.
That's
like,
an amazing story. Yeah.
And
yeah. We can all commiserate with those moments. I was telling you off air about those moments that, you know, again, movies and what you do, and we reference you all the time. So you are that for us in so many ways, where you can attach memories to those things. And that moment of your dad saying, maybe, and it stuck, and there you are.
There
it's
we
just
were. My mom was so like, I can't believe it.
Yeah.
She was, and I was like, you know, I was like, Ma, you know, she was like, your father, I was like, he didn't. It wasn't a plan. He didn't say it going like, this kid will, like, honestly, I'm sure he was like, the fat one? He's going nowhere, you know? He likes Hollywood. Let's encourage that and stuff. So
your sister's in Cabrini.
Exactly. Like, yeah. She's the college kid. She'll wind up here. So to have it, like, to have it happen, my mom was, like, blown away. She was crying the whole time and whatnot. Like, that was, you know, anyone who likes her son, of course she likes that because she's
right.
A mom. But my mom is also, like, she can't hear this, so I can say this. My mom loves being Kevin Smith's mother.
Yeah.
Oh, she spends it like currency, man. She goes in every Publix in Florida, and she's like, you know who my son is? And then she'll tell them, and they'll be like, I don't know who that is, man. But she loves it so much. So that day, seeing all that, she was like, they love you in Hollywood, Tiger. I was like, just here today.
That's awesome.
By the way, I typed in Kevin on IMDb, and there's only one Kevin above you. So do you know who
Hold
that
on.
Is?
Let's try to, let me. Klein, Costner, or God forbid, Spacey?
Costner.
Costner, thank the Lord. Yeah. All right. That's not bad. That's not bad.
You outrank Bacon, man.
That's not bad either.
Yeah.
Holy crap.
I mean, and Feige's not even on that first page.
He deserves to be there. That's the guy, for those listening at home don't know, Kevin Feige is the guy that, like, is responsible for the Marvel Universe. So if you've had any joy with these movies over the course of the last decade, that's the engineer. Yes, these movies have directors and writers, but there's somebody in a God seat going, we should do this. We should do this. And that's been Kevin for like over a decade.
Who kept it tonally correct all the way throughout.
All the way through.
That's why I look at things like the Harry Potter films, that even though you had multiple directors and things like that, that it still maintained that series,
that tone all
that
the way
sense
through.
Of whimsy and that magic is unbelievably difficult.
He's
so, yeah.
This guy, most important person in this business. He's a modern day like Walt Disney. And I don't say that like because I'm like, oh, I want to work with him. I love Kevin. Like,
right.
But I don't want to make those movies and stuff. But I blow him up every chance I get. When I had the heart attack, I got a phone call one day and they were just like, hold for Kevin Feige. And I was like, what? And Kevin Feige called up and he goes, look, I just want you to know. He's like, I'm glad you're good. I'm glad you're okay. He's going, but as a Kevin from New Jersey that wanted to be in the movie business, like, you going first meant everything to me. Like, people come out of the woodwork to give you their flowers while you're above ground when you go through something like that. If I had died, they'd be saying nice stuff in my absence. But he took the time to actually call and say some nice things to me and stuff. And I was like, oh, my God, that means the world. You guys are crushing it and stuff. And then the phone call ended, and I could not wait to tell people. I'm like, Kevin Feige called me. My wife was like, oh, my God, does he want you to make a Marvel movie? And I was like, well, that never occurred to me. And now you just ruined the phone call.
We had Ryan Johnson in studio like two weeks ago.
He's a lovely human being.
So, but I had asked him because when he was...
Did you guys see Knives Out yet?
Not yet. We will. Fantastic. Yeah. But, with The Last Jedi,
yeah.
I'd asked him, I said, when, you know, that was presented to you, was there ever a hesitation? Like, oh, I don't... What if I ruin it? You know, what if I ruin this franchise?
Right.
And it wasn't even a thought to him.
Nah. I would imagine. Well, for me, if somebody was like, you want to make a Star Wars? I'd be like, nah, I want to see a Star Wars.
Yeah.
And more importantly, if somebody was like, you want to make a Star Wars? I'd be like, no, but can I be in it?
Yeah.
Because that would be huge for me.
Well, like, you talk about the whole notion, and I agree with this, about when you see how the sausage is made, you know, yeah. using that idea. You know how great it is to savor the experience as an audience member, and that to me, in many cases, would override, let you do it and make it really good, and I want to see it.
Well, I look at it this way. Like, I'm married. I've been married for 20 years, going on 21 years, and me and the wife, Jen, we have lots of sex, and that's not bragging. It's just that's how we stay married and stuff. There are other attractive people in the world.
Yeah.
I don't have sex with all of them. You know what I'm saying? Just like, I love those Marvel movies, but just because I make movies don't mean I got to make a Marvel movie, man. The same way, like, I'm faithful to my movies and stuff, but I can certainly look and appreciate and be like, wow, that's a damn fine film and stuff like that.
Right.
I do more looking at movies than I do it in real life. Jay is the actual, like, Jay and his wife, it's really adorable. Jay is, like, the kind of guy that's like, hello. Like, he's always looking at people and stuff, and not in a lascivious way, right, but he's always looking... And I was like, man, you married now. And she's like, she likes that I look around. I was like, I don't think that's the case at all.
I have to ask.
He's such a married man, too, man, and an incredible dad. That guy makes me proud every day because he really shouldn't be here. Like, he almost killed himself multiple times with heroin and OxyContin. It's a miracle that he's alive, man. And then for years I was like, he's only put on this earth to play Jay. That's the only thing I think he's good at. And so, like, thank the Lord he found that. But him being a dad, that's what he was put
there's,
here to
there's
do.
So much that's improbable about both of you.
Yeah,
so
more much. Him than me, yeah, to be honest with you.
And yet still, sometimes, you just step back and it happens the way it was meant to be.
Truly.
And it's very cool. I have to ask you about Matt Reeves and the Batman and Rob Pattinson, who I think could be a very
fantastic
good choice.
Fantastic idea. Rob Pattinson, of course, we all know him as the sparkly vampire kid from Twilight series. But he was an actor prior to that, and he was an actor after that, in terms of, like, actor, meaning, like, he was going for serious roles. He was in the Safdie Brothers movie. He's always going. He was in a Cronenberg picture.
Water for Elephants, very good
he's
in.
He's always, like, doing performance-driven stuff. Like, even though he had Twilight, he could have just been a genre kid. But it was important to him, seemingly, to go do some strong work. And it's led back to genre.
Right.
So, you know, I'm happy for him. Do I think he'll be a good Batman? Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, you put that suit on anybody.
Yeah.
They put that suit on Michael Keaton, and we all believed it. That was Mr. Mom from 86. So I think, you know, like, he'll probably put on some muscle and stuff like that, and I think he'll be able to pull it off. But where I think he'll really pull it off is Bruce Wayne.
Because
Batman is a dude in a suit, man. Like, you put a mask on somebody, and basically Batman's truly a stuntman at the end of the day, somebody who's doing all the fake punching and stuff like that. To nail that role, you got to nail Bruce Wayne. And I think that dude will be a very brooding, emo Bruce Wayne. I think he'll work out.
I agree 100%. Yeah, and Matt Reeves to me is, I don't know if you're a
wonderful
fan
filmmaker.
I was not that big into him, and then I eventually revisited them, and I'm like, these movies are effing good.
They're really good. I have a disconnect with them, though, because I grew up with the 70s Planet of the Apes, where, you know, Roddy McDowell is wearing rubber makeup, and that to me is a talking chimpanzee.
Yeah.
And then you see these movies, and like, they spent an awful lot of money to get the same effect. Everyone's CG with the dots all over and stuff like that. I grew up with the tactile version of it, so I'm more affectionate about those. But I do love what he did with those Planet of the Apes movies. For a new generation, it was like, oh, that's great, man. I'm more of the low-tech guy. But I think he'll be a fantastic Batman guy. And he's been working on this for, what, 2 years at this point?
Yeah, I'm very excited.
And who did they just announce? Colin Farrell is going to be...
The Penguin.
Interesting choice. So they're not doing, like, heavyset Penguin and stuff.
Right.
And nice that they don't feel tied to that anymore. Because every heavyset actor in town was like, who will play the Penguin?
You know, Paul Dano.
Who?
Paul Dano's going to be Riddler.
Riddler. And then did I hear something about McConaughey, or is that a rumor?
I don't know if that's been confirmed. But
I don't see him on the list right now.
Rumor was possibly Harvey Dent, which I found kind of interesting.
Will he take his shirt off on it?
I wonder. Will he play the bongos? That's the bigger question. But yeah, that man, that movie's shaping up to be something kind of special. And it sounds like they're doing more detective Batman than, you know, look at all my gadgets. Look at all my muscles. It's more the thinking.
That's always, he was always, I know, obviously,
the world's greatest detective. That's how they sell him and stuff. And in the movies, never quite as much. It's more about the gack and the tech. And I got all the money and stuff. So it'd be nice to see them do him as the modern day Sherlock Holmes, the guy who detects, the criminologist.
Yeah. All right, so it's 8:30. I know you got
to
get running.
I'm going to Boston, man.
Jay and Silent Bob reboot. What are those? So Neshaminy, Cherry Hill, and...
what was the other one?
Hamilton?
Hold on, I got it right here.
You said Hamilton.
Hamilton.
Yeah. And that's going to be this weekend you can get out and see
That's right. Today. It's open. Today. Neshaminy, Cherry Hill, and Hamilton, the 24th.
Are the dates up on your site?
You can go see on my Twitter or on rebootroadshow.com has all the information, or you can just hit fandango.com. It's a wonderful movie. People who see it with me seem to like it. I've not talked to anybody who saw it without me yet, so I can't vouch for that.
We're going
to
go see
it. Wide release is November 29th, so that's
Wide release is like basically, there's never like, we're on 2,000 screens. Everywhere we tour the movie, then it comes out.
Okay.
So we're never having like a big-ass wide release.
Okay. All right.
This is more platform release.
I'm on board. Listen, you're the best.
You guys rock. Thank you.
Love that
me.
You came by here. Thanks.
You guys are the only people in the world I'd get up for 3 hours of sleep. And I was like, you know what? I would talk to those guys.
Give Jay our best.
I will.
And let's hear it for Kevin, guys.
Pleasure, kids. Have a great day, Philly.
Want more Preston and Steve? Get the whole show podcast or Bizarre Files at PrestonandSteve.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.